From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard Florida made the creative class a buzzword, hot ticket, and holy grail a decade ago. Freelancers and free thinkers, artists and entrepreneurs, he said, were the new bearers of economic mojo, the new culture definers and wealth creators. Attract them or die, he seemed to say. Embrace them and prosper. 10 years on, how's that going? This hour on Point, Richard Florida and the creative class revisited. You can join the conversation. Is this you, your town, your city? How's your creative class act going in the age of economic downturn? Are you freelancing and free thinking your way to prosperity? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Richard Florida, director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, global research professor at NYU, author of 2002's big book, The Rise of the Creative Class, and its 10th year anniversary updated edition, just out titled The Rise of the Creative Class Revisited. Richard Florida, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, Tom, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me back.
How's your class doing on this side of everything we've seen in the last 10 years?
Well, it's been a really interesting 10 years. You know, we had the tragedy of 9/11. We had the tech crisis in the early part of the decade. And then, of course, we had the great economic crisis of 2008. And in each one of those turns, you know, people said, well, this whole thing that folks are talking about, the rise of a more knowledge or innovation or what I term the creative economy, well, that's gonna turn around. We're going to go back to the old-fashioned way. You know, we're going to put our ties back on and go back to the office and, you know, go back to the old kind of old style economy. But what's really been interesting through all of those traumas, and it's been a really difficult decade, is this creative economy has grown more powerful. And in fact, one startling fact that I learned in doing this revision was as our economy cratered and tragically and traumatically, as blue-collar working people saw the rate of unemployment not only hit 10% but hit 15%, production workers saw their rate of unemployment go across 20%, construction workers saw their rate of unemployment go across 25%. If you take the creative class, those of us fortunate enough to work in journalism, although journalism has been hard hit, or artists, but also scientists, technologists, people who work in management occupations, people who work in healthcare, law, education, that rate of unemployment never touched 5%. So I think that creativity has been a big strong point of our economy. And, you know, what's interesting, and when a number of websites ask people how they would define themselves, increasingly the word creative has come up, and you know, people are beginning to see their own creativity as an economic driving force in their own life. So I think the creative economy has gotten more powerful over the past 10 years, if anything.
Did you always define it so broadly? I mean, you talk about the creative economy, and it brings to mind, you know, these sort of wonderful images of funky artists in lofts and, you know, little shops. But here you're saying technologists and healthcare and law, and pretty soon that thread to creativity is not necessarily so obvious. To me, anyway, you know, you're drawing blood. I hope you do it very well, but, you know, you're drawing blood. Have you expanded the palette, or is how do you, you know, is that definition really outlining a extra creative class?
Well, let's go back to the basics, because that's a really great question. You know, I'm a senior editor at The Atlantic, where we founded a website called The Atlantic Cities, and I have a piece coming out in the next couple of weeks. I just have to have some time to work on it, kind of the great myths about the creative class. And one of those myths is the creative class is just artists and, you know, street musicians and other so-called bohemians or cultural creatives.
You do celebrate them, and you do hold them up as kind of signifiers of where it's going to grow.
Yeah, we can talk about that in a second, mm-hmm, but I think what's really interesting is when I was writing the book, I really went back to the basics of people like Dan Bell, who had written the great sociologist, the book The Post-Industrial Society, or the Peter Drucker, who's one of my two idols, along with the great urbanist Jane Jacobs, who had identified the rise of the knowledge worker. Mm-hmm. And what I was trying to do was distinguish this great economic transformation that now we are really in the middle of. Of course, the crisis defined it. This movement from an industrial age to an age of knowledge or an age of innovation or an age of information or technology. And when I looked at the data, and actually looked at the occupational data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that collects all such measures of what people do, I wanted to pick occupations that not only use knowledge. I said to myself, what is sort of the most fundamental thing that human beings do that differentiate us from other species? You know, and Marx had written in his great works, whether you like Marx or not, he was very insightful on the notion that human beings use their physical labor. He called that the working class, the proletariat. What made a working class was the use of physical labor, backs and bronze and strength.
Yep.
Well, I was reading some of the great psychologists like Sternberg and others, many of them, and they said what really distinguishes human beings is not our physical strength and labor. It's this thing that we all have and we all share called our creativity. So I tried my darndest to identify occupations where people principally use their knowledge or their intellectual labor or their creativity. And that ends up being about a third of us in the United States as a whole have the great good fortune to use our creativity principally as a way to make money, to make our salaries. And in some metro areas, almost 50% of us, and in some counties, you know, which are a smaller unit than metros, almost two-thirds of us. So the group is getting larger. And there's just one thing I want to say because mm-hmm. your question is so important. I really believe the key to our time in overcoming the class divides and inequality that vex us is seeing every person as a creative person and upskilling all work, simple work, routine work, factory work, service work, low-skill work. I think one of the keys to making our economy stronger has to be to tap that creativity. Now, not everybody is Jimi Hendrix or Steven Jobs. You know, I wanted to be more like Jimi Hendrix. I wanted to be a guitar player. But everyone does have that creative element that we could stoke. It will make their work more meaningful and purposeful, make their lives better, and it will also help drive productivity and hopefully a little bit more equality in our economy.
Look, I'm really into creativity, and I really hope you're right that it boosts economies. But I'm not sure what making everybody into a creative means. I mean, if you're processing chicken on a Tyson food line, what does it mean to be a creative?
Tom, another fantastic question, and it goes back to your previous segment as well about the Amazon economy. Mm. When I was first started out as a professor and a researcher, I didn't study creative neighborhoods or places like Brooklyn or the Bay Area or in Silicon Valley. I started off as a professor at Ohio State and then later spent nearly 20 years at Carnegie Mellon. And I was trying to understand both the deindustrialization and reindustrialization of the great American Midwestern heartland. So my initial projects, well before rise of the creative class, were studying factories. So I went around and studied factories all throughout Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Indiana, up through Ontario. I teach at the University of Toronto now. I went to Japan. I went to Europe. And I began to learn something very important, that the factories that were surviving and prospering. And I remember visiting this factory outside Nagoya, and the plant manager said,
in Japan.
Professor Florida, in Nagoya, Japan, he said, we're going to beat the big three. And I was giggling to myself at who's going to beat the big three? You know, I'm an American. It's the 1980s. Who's going to beat the big three? He said, the reason is not because of your company, your technology. You have great technology and research units. He said, you treat your workers terribly. You know, we are going to win because we treat our workers as a part of our company, and we harness their knowledge and their innovation, and he actually used the word their creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So where companies are most successful is when they begin to view the worker as a source of knowledge and ideas and form them into teams. And there's – Tom, there, and listeners, there's a wonderful study that just came out from the MIT Sloan School reported in the Harvard Business Review. This fellow went and he looked at the lowest skilled routine service work in call centers and retail shops and all of this work that we just think in America, you know, 60 million Americans do this kind of work, nearly half of our workforce. It's something I've been very big on as well. But he went out and studied these service companies and he found, just as in the best factories, when you tap into people's creativity, when you encourage them to innovate and use their minds, when you engage them in their work and you pay them better, that factory and that service business get a higher rate of innovation, a higher rate of productivity, and a higher rate of profit. And I think that's really where we have to go in our economy. No, not everyone's going to be a great creative genius, Some will, and that's a great fact of our economy. But many people have creativity they can contribute, and that's where we have to go in our economy.
Unleash the creative class, Richard Florida said a decade ago, and you will prosper. Creative genius, he said, kind of at the heart of it, along with tolerance and talent and technology. He's got an index for cities across this country. And who's got the highest creativity index? We'll look at that, where that's been migrating. But sort of 1 through 8 here, Boulder, Colorado, San Francisco, Boston, Cambridge, Quincy, Ann Arbor, Seattle, Tacoma, San Diego, Corvallis, Durham, Oregon, Durham, North Carolina, and right on down. 10 years on, he says, it is still the key factor. Richard Florida, stand by there if you'd be good enough in New York. We really want to open the phone lines to our creative class. We've got listeners in a lot of those cities. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
And it's just a box of rain.
We're talking this hour about the economic power of the creative class, artists, innovators, entrepreneurs, and how it's proven out or not since my guest Richard Florida made the label hot 10 years ago now. He's out with the 10th anniversary edition of his big book, The Rise of the Creative Class, revisited for the 10th anniversary. A lot of new material in here looking back on how it's all unfolded. Joins us today from New York. Richard, we've got a lot of people lining up to talk with you. Marcia in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Marcia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm from the Midwest. I speak kind of slow, and I've got 3 points, so perhaps you could bear with me.
Go for it.
As I say each one, and then I'll take the comments off air. The first one is about the Sloan study. I'm not sure if they're studying firms or companies or what their sample is, but I work for the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, and we study individuals. And what we have found, what we asked as a special topic in 2011 was, are you starting a business for your employer? So we asked individuals if that's what they're doing, and we have some findings about that. And I just wondered how that might correlate with the Sloan study.
Well, we have no idea. Take us on, Marcia.
Well,
we don't know the results of your study, so we really don't know.
Well, rather than go into the findings, I thought I would just throw that out
okay.
there.
Okay, what else?
And my second point is that the creatives are photographers or yoga teachers or coffee, you know, baristas who mm-hmm. start a small roastery and then open up and maybe hire 10 to 12 people. If the economy grows the most strongly when it's business-to-business activity rather than individual retail or service entities, does the creative class just attract bigger companies, or do they actually impact the environment, the city? And my third point is, I have a Master of Fine Arts in poetry, and for 25 years I've worked for health insurance, to be quite honest. With Obamacare, if it passes, if it looks like it's something I can take advantage of, I would be able to, and I hope my company's not listening, I would be able to leave, seriously, and do something I've always wanted to do.
So maybe it would free you up, maybe it would free others up. Marcia, thank you for your call. Richard Florida, I don't know about these two studies and how they might compare. Any idea there?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you, Marcia, for all 3 points. And Tom, I'm going to work backward on Marcia's 3 points. First of all, I think she's right about healthcare and the availability of health insurance. Now, I'm not an expert in this, but we do live in Canada, my wife and I, part of the year. And my students and researchers have found something very interesting. The rate of self-employment in Canada and is much higher than in the United States. They may be single person enterprises, and one reason is as my research team has found, at least initial studies, is because people feel that they don't have to work for health insurance. So I think that having a common pool or having health insurance can stimulate entrepreneurship. I agree with her. Jumping to her first point, I'm actually a very big fan of the what we call the GEM study, the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor.
Okay.
And I think they've come to some very interesting findings about entrepreneurship. My hunch is that the Sloan study that I was mentioning and the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor are similar in one respect, that the same factors that drive an individual to be entrepreneurial and take risks stem from that individual's underlying creativity. So if we can harness more of that creativity and unleash it, we get more entrepreneurship, which brings me to her middle point. I think the real issue, it's not so much retail or B2B. It's how do we equip creative people who typically are not business oriented. And I've learned this the hard way because, you know, my wife, who I married in the past decade, is business oriented. And for a long time, I would do all of these creative things, but I was very terrible at running a business. Well, my wife's very good at running a business and executing and operating. I learned that from a partner how important those skills are. When I've been studying musicians and rock and roll and independent music acts, also jazz acts, hip-hop and rap, what you find is that the ones that are successful often have a partner, a spouse, or a parent who has a business background. So one of the things that folks like Marcia and I can do in comparing our studies is begin to help creatives learn, and our business schools can do this, our community colleges can do this, our nonprofit training programs can do this, begin to assist creatives learn these necessary business and financial and management skills, which will make their small independent free agent businesses and freelancing and enterprises a bit more possibly successful.
And let's go to the middle one in the sandwich there that she raises, the question of whether creatives, attract economic activity or create economic activity, or really to expand that, because, you know, you've got critics who say your creatives really ride along on top of economic activity. I mean, the really tough ones who say, your creatives is like saying that a high number of hot dog vendors in New York City is what's causing the presence of so many investment bankers, people who say it's the other way around. What have you seen over this decade on whether creatives are really the engines of economic growth, or they're sort of ornaments on top of economic growth?
Well, in one level, there's no debate, and I'll get back to this so-called mm-hmm. chicken and egg question. If you look at the wide consensus, and people always – it's like the narcissism of small differences. There's a general consensus amongst economists and social scientists and people who study economic growth that human capital – broadly speaking, is a major driver of economic growth. Now, there are a number of ways of measuring human capital. Many economists measure that by the level of education you have.
College degree, that's, human capital.
It's a very good measure and highly correlated with my own measure, about at the level of 0.9 if they're statisticians. My measure just tried to do something a little different. I wanted to document people who do work that uses their knowledge or talent or human capital or creativity. Now, about 9 in 10 people with a college degree are members of the creative class, but get this, and I think this is a very important finding. Only 60% of the members of the creative class do have a college degree. That means 40% of those who work in the creative class do not. And the findings of a great economist, Todd Gabe at the University of Maine, suggest even controlling for education, having a creative occupation versus having a blue-collar occupation or service work adds the equivalent of an additional 1.5 years of education. So on this, there's no argument that human capital defined as the creative class or as a college degree has a powerful effect on economic growth. The debate is really over, does arts and culture drive economic development? Now, first of all, that's not an argument that I made principally. I argued very clearly that openness to new ideas, tolerance drives economic growth. But even on this question of whether arts and cultural creativity drives economic growth, that's a very hard question to parse. There are many people who want us to believe that arts and culture only come about after a place gets very wealthy. I think when you look at the history of regions, whether that's the New York City region or San Francisco Bay Area or wherever, you will note that these two things tend to grow up in tandem. And just one last remark.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fantastic study, which I adore, that came out of Germany by this incredibly eccentric, brilliant economist named Michael Fritsch. He tried to look at this. And he threw a monkey wrench at these critics who want to say arts always follows economic growth, because it's a very complicated question. He actually looked, folks listening in, at German Baroque opera houses that were set up before the Industrial Revolution. What he found is that communities that had Baroque opera houses tended to grow at a higher level, controlling for all other factors. So the point is, we don't know. We don't know if art generates economic development or creativity follows economic growth. We know it's a very complicated iterative process. But to me, it seems like the arrow points in both directions. And it's a gross oversimplification to say either art always precedes and artistic creativity always precedes economic growth. That's certainly not true. Mm-hmm. But it's equally a gross simplification to say you have to be wealthy and then you can buy up artists and they come to your town because you're rich. I think they both influence one another to a degree.
Richard Florida is out with the 10th anniversary edition of The Rise of the Creative Class, revisited in this case. We'll hear in just a moment from James Galbraith, economist. We've got lots of feedback here. Let's see. Katie writes to us online, Richard Florida. She says, yes, I'm part of the creative class. And I'm not doing well. Not at all. It's rough out there. It looks as though she's a dancer, Richard. She says, everyone is circling the wagons, and they don't want an extra mouth to feed. So there's that perspective. Let me put up a couple more here. Christopher says, great. As a landscape architect, I recently earned my license, got a significant raise in salary, and I'm working on a $6 million residential landscape job. Wow. The 1%, Christopher writes, is still spending, and they appreciate luxury goods like interior design and landscape architecture. Mm-hmm. There's your creative class prospering with the 1%. Then Jim writes, and maybe this is related, he says, the creative class is now becoming the elitist class. If you notice, the creative class is concentrated in areas where housing is quite expensive. What about that, Array?
Well, you know, clearly for many people, they are struggling out there, and particularly people in the fine arts and visual arts. And I think one thing that we have to train people is how to begin to use those skills in other domains, at least for a while. And one of the things that our studies in the past decade have shown by our research team at the Martin Prosperity Institute is that many visual artists, performing artists, musicians are good at mixing income streams. That's not a wonderful answer, by the way. That's not a wonderful world I'm painting, but creative class people have the flexibility to mix income streams in a way a blue-collar worker, when they're let go, they have no other income stream because their income was tied to that particular job. Clearly, the other listener is right. One way that creativity has become more important to our economy is things like interior design, and not just at the high end. You know, shops like
$6 million landscape design.
That's of course, wow. but in landscaping. But where this is positive, I think, is when communities get better at placemaking and greening. You know, yesterday in New York, I went for a walk on the High Line. And people can complain about the High Line all they want, but
this is the beautiful new elevated walk on the Lower West Side there.
It's a wonderful exercise in building at a relatively low expense compared to a giant convention center or baseball stadium, building a community facility. So I think that's important. But I'm looking forward to actually this conversation with Professor Galbraith, because my book and his new work, I think, are come to a common conclusion from a different angle. And this is the last point, that our society is becoming terribly class divided. And that is the biggest thing I've learned in rewriting this book. You know, I could see the rise of the creative class. I could see what it was bringing to communities like Austin or Seattle or the Bay Area. What I think I missed in the first edition was that this tremendous divide in red and blue, political, liberal and conservative, you know, this class divide, we have to bring class back into the conversation in America. Well, we are becoming a terribly divided society, not only by political orientation, but by where we live and how we live. He is right. The listener is right. Our society is becoming ever more divided in a very dysfunctional way. And we've got to get that conversation going, and we've got to get on track to being less divided.
We'll talk about whether or how the creative class factors into that, whether it exaggerates or helps close that divide. Richard Florida, author of The Rise of the Creative Class, revisited, 10th anniversary edition, been a very influential voice in people thinking about their communities, their careers, their creativity over the last decade. With us now from Townsend, Vermont, is James Galbraith. He's professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. James Galbraith, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you with us and Richard Florida today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you.
So, you know, it's exciting to think of the creative class as a real economic engine. It gives us a sense of a more sort of colorful economy and country and life. What do you make of the thesis and how it's proven out or not?
I'm a bit late to this particular party, but listening to the conversation just now, I have to confess to a good deal of skepticism. There is a tradition in this kind of work, a great game of category building and label making, and I know Richard Florida is a past master at that and has came up a dozen years ago with a very catchy concept in which many people find attractive because in many ways it speaks to values that we all find appealing: art, culture, tolerance, diversity. But the connection to the rise and decline of the American economy strikes me as one that's been not made effectively at all. It seems to me there's a vast fallacy of composition involved in taking some examples of urban centers that have particular characteristics and then saying that one can spread those characteristics over the whole country in all of its different economic activities and facets, and that every part of it, by following a formula, can achieve the same level of success, prosperity, and economic growth.
But if you roll in innovators and entrepreneurs, isn't that a lot of what the American economic engine has grown on, Professor Gaba?
Yes, but a lot of the success of entrepreneurs is differential. It is what the economist Joseph Schumpeter called creative destruction. It comes at somebody else's expense. So the notion that everybody can become an entrepreneur and everybody can prosper is just a fallacy. What you'll have when you have these moments of great success, and they're not necessarily bad things, but what they produce are pockets of great success, and they may also produce pockets of large areas, swaths of depression in their wake. But even that is a story which applies very well, for example, to the 1990s, but doesn't apply at all to what happened in the 2000s when economic growth, such as it was largely driven by real estate scams, by the subprime mortgage boom, the housing construction, and ultimately all of that came to grief in the collapse of the banking sector. It's very hard for me to understand what, if one includes, for example, bankers amongst the creative class, and I believe Professor
Ford. They've been creative.
Yeah, that there is certainly a lot of financial creativity there, but it's very hard for me to see this as a model for what we have to do going forward. So it seems to me the whole thing is a little bit, it's stretching enormously to treat this as a theory of economic growth in general.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the economic power of the creative class, artists, innovators, entrepreneurs, and how it's proven out or not since my guest Richard Florida made the label hot 10 years ago. He's out with the 10th anniversary edition of his big book, The Rise of the Creative Class, revisited this time a decade on. Joins us today from New York. James Galbraith is with us as well, author of Inequality and Instability, professor of government at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Relations, and Lloyd Benson Jr. Chair in Government and Business Relations at the University of Texas at Austin. Richard, James, we've got a kind of certainly a conversation, maybe a debate set up here. If I may just inform it with a few of our listener comments and we'll dive right in. Here's what Janie writes to us. She says, I live in southern Vermont. where lots of people bought into the idea of a creative sector reviving the economy. She says, but the economic base can't support quality in the creative efforts. Many artists are still trust funders. In short, the arts have been no substitute for real economic development, which is desperately needed in rural and semi-rural areas. Let's just hold that one and get a couple of calls, and we'll come to you both, Charles in New York City. Charles, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. My sense is that people took the book so very seriously 10 years ago, and now the creative market is absolutely saturated. Every small restaurant in New York has a chef trained in a culinary institute. Every little bar has people coming around with great talent. And the problem with that is there's just not enough money to go around to support these people. And the market is, as I said, seems to be saturated. I'll take your response off the air.
Charles in New York, I appreciate that. I'll get one more and take it to my guest, Zach, in Lexington, Kentucky. Zach, you've been very patient. What do you see going on?
I think they ought to move to the center of the country where there's an opportunity for people in the creative class or the productive class to use the crumbling infrastructure in new ways. I went from Seattle, Tacoma, where I came 37 years ago, where there was a billboard that said, will the last person leaving Seattle please shut out the lights? And I saw Seattle build itself up to be a major cultural powerhouse. But the bottom line is it's very, very expensive to live in Seattle. As much as I love it, I've tried something different. I've come to Lexington, Kentucky, which is a very educated, it's a university town. I started a business here selling the seafood products from the Northwest to restaurants. And it's a tough row to hoe, but I see young people coming here because you can buy it. You can live here cheaply. You can start things on your own. You can do things that the major creative centers like San Francisco, New York, and Seattle, all of which I've lived in, we're pricing the young people out. How are we going to sustain these things in the future?
So bring it to the middle of the country and find a cost basis you can build on. Zach, thank you for that. Let me take it to Richard Florida and James Galbraith. Richard Florida, let me come to you. We've got a lot on the table here. You hear James Galbraith wondering if this creative class work isn't still in some way derivative, doubting that it can work in a lot of places. And then you hear the range of responses from our listeners and callers. Richard Florida.
Well, sure. As and for Professor Galbraith, as I said, I'm a big admirer of his work. But I fear that perhaps he's reacting to a straw man construction, and perhaps he hasn't read the revised edition of the book, nor many of the empirical studies published in leading journals like the Journal of Economic Geography and other important places that bear on this work. So just to be very plain about it, what my work tries to do is look at the clustering and concentration geographically of high-skill occupations. The book gave them a term he may or may not enjoy, the creative class, but they are basically documentable from the BLS data, and now using ONET data, these are the highest skill occupations in our country. What I found, and also a person I debate, but we have some consensus, Edward Glaser found looking at human capital, the economist at Harvard, is that they are diverging. I'm not trying to foist upon communities that everyone will become a creative class center. In fact, my work suggests that the divergence of places that have high concentrations of these occupations versus those that have low is getting wider. And that is a big factor in not only socioeconomic inequality, Professor Galbraith has written so eloquently and importantly about, but it gives it a geographic dimension that compounds socioeconomic inequality. Now, one bright spot on the horizon that the caller mentions, which I think is very important, there was a time, not me, I lived in Pittsburgh, I wrote about Pittsburgh's revival, I was hopeful for its revival, and it's gotten much better since over the past 10 years. But there were many people who were counting out the Rust Belt, some of whom tried to paint me with that brush. In fact, I adore the Rust Belt. I spend most of my career in the Rust Belt. I care deeply about the Midwest. One of the bright spots on the horizon is the rise of Rust Belt communities, in particular Rust Belt college towns. And you know, before I had looked at the places like San Jose or even Professor Galbraith's own Austin, Texas, or Boulder as places that had achieved a high-skill economy for good and bad. Ann Arbor rises over the past decade to the very top. And also, you know, I just want to say one other thing for the caller from Lexington. You know, my other great mentor was Jane Jacobs, and I learned so much from Jane Jacobs. She had a great quote.
Urban visionary.
The urban visionary from Scranton, by way of New York and then Toronto. And she said about urban revitalization, when a place gets boring, even the rich people leave. And I think that captures what happens in so much of these kind of uber-precious, overly gentrified neighborhoods, that the creative spark gets drained out. And what happens, of course, and we just did a video series for The Atlantic on this, you can see a migration now of young, talented people seeking affordable, cheap space to the inner city centers of places like Detroit. And that's a very – so this dynamic, and this dynamic of creative destruction for good and bad that Professor Galbraith talks about goes on and spreads itself geographically. And what my work has tried to get at are what some of the characteristics of places that engage that. And then importantly, and I think we should talk more about this, how that geographic process of development causes not only socioeconomic inequality but really reinforces with a geographic dimension the great class divide and socioeconomic inequality this country faces.
We'll come to that. Let me just ask you first, before I go to James, about Charles in New York, Janie in Southern Vermont, both in a way saying, Charles saying, we're saturated, oversaturated with creatives, and the economic base won't support it. And Janie's finding the same thing, seeming to suggest you've got to develop the wealth somewhere else to support this. It's not doing it itself.
Well, wealth comes from people. People create wealth. I mean, for all of human history, people's talent and ability, and not the shenanigans of bankers.
But we're making a distinction. You're saying creatives here, and they're saying, well, we're the creatives, and the other people, I mean, you're drawing lines, the people who aren't creatives aren't creating enough wealth to support us.
Human skill, human talent builds wealth. Human beings coming together in cities and communities, they create wealth. Isn't just magically created.
Of course not.
So the real key is to unleash and to work and develop human talents to a greater degree in communities. Markets don't magically develop to support people. People have to do this. And I think what we've learned, and Professor Galbraith said this quite rightly, these speculative bubbles that we can believe that we can build economies through financial shenanigans or flipping homes is a false economy. We have to build our economy by building up human talent. I call that creative talent. We could call it human skill, the skill of a chef, of a hairdresser, of someone making manufactured products, of delivering a better service. We have to unleash that creative potential. So in my view, creativity is not a zero sum. It, following Paul Romer, investing in human ideas and human creativity is a positive sum game and really the source of wealth at bottom.
James Galbraith, step back with us then. How do we – this can sound like an apparent contradiction here. How do we resolve it? This Richard Florida saying we all need to be creatives now. And I hear you saying, well, this creates just pockets of growth and prosperity.
Well, I think both of the last two callers put their fingers on a very important aspect of this, which is the great concentration of the activities that Richard Florida celebrates in a small number of very successful places. You ask what's driving the concentration of small restaurants in New York City, and it's clearly the fact that it's the financial capital of the world. And that is where the bankers and their incomes are, and that provides a vast economic foundation for a lot of very, small players. A caller talked about Seattle, the last caller did. What drove the economic revival of Seattle? Always had Boeing, one of the country's most successful corporations, and Microsoft went there and associated high-tech activities. And it's clearly that which then is the driver for the cultural transformation of Seattle. But not every city can have a Microsoft. It's just not the way the world works. And similarly, if you go to take some of the examples that Richard Florida just gave of the most creatively successful cities, I mean, I've heard the name Ann Arbor, Boulder, Austin. I love Austin. I live there. I've lived there for almost 30 years now. But it's, not the most important city in Texas. It's very small in comparison with Houston or Dallas or San Antonio. It is, a concentration of university town and a very nice place to live. But you can't build the economy of a state like Texas on a city like Austin. Boulder is a small town next to Denver. Ann Arbor doesn't begin to compare in importance to Detroit. So we're looking here at, in each case, university towns, which, again, are lovely places to live if you happen to have the right sort of occupation to live there. And certainly they attract a lot of young people because they attract students, many of whom stick around. But they are not the remotely the foundation of a continental economy.
Let me turn it around a little bit, if I may, then, James Gabbett, just for a minute, because we have seen at the level of some of those big older industries, tremendous competition from abroad, great job loss in this country as a result. We're told again and again we've got to climb the education ladder, and I think we've been left with a sort of natural resonance with Richard Florida's ideas that we have to imagine and create our way to success in the global economy. It can't be raw, brute competition.
Going out beyond the the examples of people going to cooking school, you have computer science as an example of this. In the 1990s, everybody thought that the route to economic success was to get a computer science degree, and colleges built up their computer science departments. But at the end of the day, the number of jobs that were available in that sector was vastly less than the number of people who wanted to have them. And so people with those degrees went off and had to do something else. We run this game on ourselves repeatedly, saying to young people in particular that if only they choose the right occupation and get themselves the right level of skills, they will be successful.
What's the pool of jobs you would look to instead, Professor?
You have to have a wide diversity of jobs. Many jobs that people are going to hold are going to be ordinary service jobs. That's what most people in the country do. They do retail. They do maintenance. They do all kinds of vital things. They do technical jobs at various levels in their communities. They work in the utilities. They do public services. They teach school. And the issue here is, do we have a society that provides a fair break for the vast majority of people who are going to be doing those kinds of jobs and who we should be proud, and are, by and large, they are proud. They have a craftsmanlike attitude toward their work, and they do a good job, but they don't meet perhaps the criteria of the ultra cool and successful.
Let me get a call here, if I may.
What's the educational system like? What kind of social security do they have? What kind of health care do they have? Is the minimum wage adequate to support a family? Those are the questions that seem to me to be fundamental for the future success.
They may not be hipsters or creatives necessarily. Steve in Boston, you're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call and enjoying the show. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take it from, I would consider myself part of the creative class. I started a business, 10 years ago in a media development area. Ended up doing pretty well using the internet and then sold it to a larger company. Mm-hmm. So now, to come back to your original question, creative class then, how is it doing now? So I'm out again starting a new business, hiring some of my old people back. And what I would see is where things are changing is kind of relating to an earlier show you had about Amazon, where you're having these internet hubs of, as far as like what we did in our last business, is we created media, which we would sell on the internet.
Right.
But what I find now is a little bit scary, which I see as it's developing, is say, and I've been using Apple products for forever, developing this stuff. But you have like a gatekeeper, like, so say I'm creating something with an Apple product, okay? I pay for their hardware. Now, say I want to use some of their tools to create it. Well, where am I going to sell that through? I might have to sell that through iTunes. So you have these internet hubs, gatekeepers, say virtual box houses, who are really taking several, I'm forced to go through. And in a long run, what does it do? It takes away some of my profit margin.
So they're skimming off your creativity a little bit. Steve, our time is so short here. I want to give it back to Richard Florida for one more go-around. You're hearing all this, Richard Florida. I guess the question where we come down here is, how did your creative class deal with this disparity in our economy? And what about the base? I mean, James Galbraith says, look, it may be an illusion that we can, be creatives now. We've got to have certain solid things for ordinary jobs, services, and all the rest. Not so creative necessarily.
Yeah, I wish Professor Galbraith would read my book instead of reacting to a straw man, and I'll send him one, especially the later chapters. I point at this very viscerally that, and I say our economy is being divided geographically and socioeconomically between knowledge workers, let's not even call them creative class, knowledge workers who are paid relatively well for their skills, about three times what a routine service worker. We document that there are over 60 million workers in the United States, nearly 45% of our workforce, doing low skill, low wage, precarious contingent service work. And I think I've been one voice in this conversation, writing in the Financial Times, writing in the New York Daily News, at the Atlantic, that the key factor facing American society today is to upgrade service work by paying workers better and investing in their skills and investing in their productivity. In fact, our own research suggests that when service workers doing these routine jobs can develop their cognitive and social skills, their wages go up, their productivity goes up, and the profits of the firms they work in and their communities get stronger. So yes, we have a great divide between knowledge workers and service workers, and our key fact we have to do going forward is to upgrade that low-wage service work that millions of Americans toil in.
We will not resolve all this today, but the open window on this has brought us a lot. I want to thank both of you, James Galbraith, author of Inequality and Instability. Thanks very much, Professor Galbraith, for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
Richard Florida, author of The Rise of the Creative Class, revisited on the 10th anniversary, excerpt at our website, Richard Florida. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, James. And thanks most of all to the callers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.